All right, good morning. A couple of housekeeping items. One, did you check in for the 10:40 service this morning? If not, shame on you. Make sure you're doing your best to check in for the 10:40 service over these next few weeks. This is going to be important for us. Also, I need to mention, last week I referenced a passage we were looking at and a theme that we had gone through in our staff retreat, and had said that Daniel Smith had brought this to us in our devotional time. It was about remembering, and ironically, it wasn't Daniel who said it, it was Blake Arrington who had said it. So ironically, I had forgotten who had taught us about remembering. And afterwards, Daniel came running up and was like, I think that was Blake, not me. And I just put it in the wrong notes. However, Daniel had an epic quote that I'm going to reference. You know how we talk about all the time, I talk about how like these analogies that we get in Scripture that are referencing somehow to God, if we're not careful, we misunderstand them, we misapply them. We say, oh, look, the Bible says that God is like an eagle, or God is like a lion, or God is like some other animal, or God is father, or God is like a mother hen. And we go, oh, you know what? Eagles are majestic. They're like a big bird. They're majestic. They're great animals. That's awesome. God's kind of like a bird. No, that's not how that works. See, there's this transcendent concept called majestic. And God is the fulfillment of that concept. He is the very definition of majestic. And so birds, big birds, they kind of remind us of His majesty. And so we say they have some of this majestic. They are the poor example. They're the shadow version of the real thing. Just like the tabernacle was the shadow version on earth of God's throne room. In the same way, mothers and fathers, that we don't go like, oh, I get this. God is kind of like a dad because we have dads here on earth. No, God is Father. Before He created anything, there was this transcendent concept called Father. And He was the perfect exemplar of that thing. Same thing with mother. He was the perfect picture of what a mother would be. And then we go, oh, there are these people on earth who kind of have some of these traits. And so they're kind of like a shadow version. Or the way Daniel said it, that I will steal and use from now on, we are the Timu version of Father. He's the real thing, and we're just the cheap knockoff, right? So this is that picture. But I need to challenge you, especially, let me take a second and challenge men. Men, we have several programs that we run during the summer for children and youth. We have Rural Family Kids Camp. We have TRAC. These are for foster kids, kids who are in the foster system, when we give them an extraordinary week of camp that's just really an awesome, awesome time. Most years, we have more campers available than we can take because we don't have enough men to serve. This year, we need a couple more already men to step up and serve in regards to our own youth camp. I know it's a big ask for people to say, hey, I'm going to take some of my vacation time and I'm going to use this to serve. But that is actually exactly what we're asking, is that people would be able to do this. We need people to serve also in this hour with kids. We had to, in the first service, I had to wait, not long, obviously, but I had to ask for 8 hands to be shown for people who would, whatever they were planning on doing at 10:40, they would instead be serving in preschool ministry. And so having been through the process, having done whatever training they needed to do, having filled out the paperwork, and then at the last minute, I need 8 hands, got 8 hands, they're over there now serving, that's great. And you're probably thinking, but Chris, how can I serve at 10:40? That makes no sense. I can't serve at 10:40. I've got a class at 9 o'clock. If I served at 10:40, when would I come to a worship service? Boy, do I have an answer for you. Starting on September 6th, we've got a third service. I know that you're used to in movie series and books, the third one's usually the worst one. Not so. Now this is going to be awesome. This 5 o'clock service starting September 6th, this is what we're going to be encouraging you to be a part of. This gives you an opportunity to go to class at 9 and serve now, and then you can come to worship at 5. Would be great. We're also going to be opening up other life groups for adults during this hour, this 10:40 hour, to encourage you also to do that. Maybe you serve at 9 or you serve at 5 and you go to this You get this hour you're serving or you're going to your life group. We've got, for example, starting, I think, kind of immediately, we have a young married couple class. So if you are a 20-something young married couple who would like to serve the first hour or sleep in the first hour and come to life group at 10:40, and then you can worship or serve at 5 starting in September, they're going to start that. They're in the process of starting it now to build towards that time in the fall in September. They're planning on working through the Bible in 3 years to study the whole Bible, to go through like that. So if you would like to be a part of that, if you're young married, if you've said, man, I've always wanted to help lead a Sunday morning class, and I think I've got a brilliant idea for what that would look like at 10:40, come let us know. We're starting to create some of those opportunities as well. And if you have questions, reach out. This week I got 2 questions, and I was so proud of these questions. It lets me know we are, as a church, where we need to be. Question number 1 was, will there be donuts at the 5 o'clock service? Not kidding. This was the first question I got, and I love it. And so the answer would be probably not donuts. They don't do well all day sitting and waiting. However, I'm sure we will do something to tip our hat to the significance of eating when it comes to hospitality. And in fact, what struck me was, given that it will probably start relatively small, maybe some of you would say, like, I like baking, we could do something homemade, a homemade table of stuff that people bring, and people would come and get to do that. That would actually probably even be a draw, like, hey, let's see what's at the table today. And so that would be great, so that we don't have to go to, like, Temu cookies or something like that. So if that's you, that would be awesome. The second question, which is even way more significant, is, will we serve communion? You may not know, at 8:40, every Sunday morning, we serve communion here before the first service, unless there are baptisms. And yes, we will do communion at 4:40 every week. So we would love for you to come to that service and come a little bit early at 4:40 and take communion with your family and with the rest of us who are here. Good. Keep those questions coming, ideas. We are super open to making this successful, and I hope we'll have a ton of fun with it. Okay, are you ready for Isaiah? Here we're jumping into Isaiah chapter 32, in which God will promise yet again to defend his people. He is, as he has revealed himself to be in Isaiah, the jealous lion, the hovering bird of prey, the purifying fire. This is what he is. He is the lion, he is the lamb, the great bird, the mother hen, the sacrificial ox, and he descends like a dove. I hope that your heart is prepared for him to descend like a dove today into your life in new ways. Are we ready to abide with him? Is always the question. He is steady. We are not. And so how do we adapt and adjust and be transformed, conformed to our Savior, to living and abiding with him? We see this over and over again in Isaiah. It's like studying Isaiah is going to end up being more and more like a musician who's practicing the same short piece over and over again to perfect it in an etude. That's what that's called. This image given to us over and over again. And we might go, God, okay, we get it. And he's like, yeah, I don't think you do. You keep repeating the same thing over and over again. And he's like, yeah, because you keep not getting it over and over again. These lessons that we see in these passages, I think, for us to hold fast. His character represented by predators and comforters, sacrifices and protectors. This promise is fulfilled clearly over and over again in Isaiah. We'll see it again in a few weeks, but the ultimate expression of it from Isaiah, because of when Isaiah is writing, is going to be fulfilled in Isaiah chapter 37. I'll go ahead and give you the heads up on this. Remember, the Assyrians are coming. This massive, unstoppable, undefeatable army. And let me just clarify, in case you've missed this, I think we can become kind of numb to the fact that everyone's always trying to wipe out Israel. Anti-Semitic thought is an ungodly, unchristian perspective. If you find yourself following along with that type of thought, anti-Semitic thought, then you're not following in line well with the Jesus Christ, and certainly not with the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul would have a significant bone to pick with you about the fact that he would literally give up his own salvation if his people, the people of Israel, could as a group accept Jesus Christ. This is a powerful messaging to us as Christians. Now, anti-anything doesn't really define us except anti-sin and death, anti-the enemies, the powers and principalities that Satan has. We are defined by our love for one another and for God's creation. With this in mind, understand, even that this Assyrian army that's coming 2,700 years ago represents a true existential threat to the nation, ethnicity, culture of the Jews. Even more than the Nazis did 100 years ago, these represent a devastating threat. Here's the Assyrians move into an area and entire cultures, their role in history runs out. We saw that several weeks ago when we looked at the history of this. The Edomites, the Moabites, the Philistines. These were a people group that, after the Assyrians came, no longer existed. And the people of Israel are a small enough culture that the Assyrians are going to wipe them out. There will be no more Jewish people. That will be the end of them forever. The few who survive will be integrated into the Assyrians, and they'll cease to exist as a culture or an ethnicity. This is truly what is coming for the people of Israel. And what will happen, here's the spoiler that I will give you now, what's going to happen when we get there in a few chapters. For my sake, Isaiah 37, God says, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. See, God had promised David to keep him a throne, that there would always be such a thing as the throne of David. So that's eventually there would be such a thing. Verse 36, and the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When people arose early the next morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. God is going to do the work. He's going to protect his people in the end. It's not the only time he's going to do this. There are several times in history. We will see it again in the very end times. In Revelation 19, verses 19 and verse 21, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. Here Jesus has stationed himself and his people there in the midst of Israel, and the armies of the entire world have declared war on him, and here they come. Verse 21, and the rest, meaning the armies of the world, were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and all the birds were gorged on their flesh. So once again, Jesus will protect, in the end, his people. So as we get into chapter 32, the chapter feels out of place. And I know this comes as a huge surprise to you, as a good Jewish audience, as a good Christian audience. You're going to be surprised by the fact there's controversy in this passage, right? How about that? A Bible passage that has controversy, right? It seems to have been in the prophecies we've been moving very clearly and steadily toward the siege of Assyria around Jerusalem, around these people, this true existential threat. God has continued to promise to protect. Don't follow your plans, he's telling them through Isaiah. I know you've got plans. They're not the right ones. Don't do them. I know you're working plans, but they're not my plans. Stick to what I'm telling you. Stay in your city. I will protect you. That's what's going to happen. And the people have to trust and trust and trust, which would have been terrifying because no one else had withstood the Assyrian army. This is what we've been building toward. He's continued to promise to protect them, to do the fighting himself. And then suddenly we get chapter 32. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness, and princes will rule in justice. Now go ahead and throw up verse 2, if you will. Notice that first word, each. So the first word in the ESV is each. Different translations put a different word here. This is part of our controversy. This verse introduces the king and these princes. Verse 2 is a description, actually through the rest of the section, is a description of this king and or these princes. But we have a problem in verse 2 in that verse 2 begins with the Hebrew word ish. Ish, you might know, means man. So, is it each prince or is it that king? Who's being described here? Is it each the king and the princes, or is it just one? And by the way, the word ish in this passage is singular. Is the description about just the king, or is it about the princes? How is this man or princes to be described? So let's look at it, and let's unpack this question, because this is a controversy in this section. Different rabbis and teachers throughout history have assigned it differently, but I think we'll come to a good answer. Verse 2. So let's look at the description all together first, and then we'll break it up. Each will be like a hiding place from the wind, a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry place, like the shade of a great rock in a weary land. Then the eyes of those who see will not be closed, and the ears of those who hear will give attention. The heart of the hasty will understand and know. The tongue of the stammerers will hasten to speak distinctly. The fool will no more be called noble, nor the scoundrel said to be honorable. For the fool speaks folly, and his heart is busy with iniquity, to practice ungodliness, to utter error concerning the Lord, to leave the craving of the hungry unsatisfied, and to deprive the thirsty of drink. As for the scoundrel, his devices are evil. He plans wicked schemes to ruin the poor with lying words, even when the plea of the needy is right. But he who is noble plans noble things, and on noble things he stands. So let's take a closer look at this. This is a profound picture of a culture changed by its leaders. These leaders, or this leader, steps in, and here's some of the consequences of them stepping in. The eyes of those who see will not be closed. The ears of those who hear will give attention. The heart of the hasty will understand and know. The tongue of the stammerers will hasten to speak distinctly. These opposites play off of each other. Those who are capable of seeing clearly will see clearly. Those who are capable of hearing the truth and understanding it will. Even those who naturally don't will. The hasty, the attention deficit disorder people who don't usually hear the whole message will hear the whole message. Those who usually can't speak will suddenly be able to speak clearly and distinctly. The opposite is also true. So those who are capable at all and those who even have never been able to will be able to hear and respond and know and share. It's a great change in the culture. But this next one feels even more miraculous to me. The opposite. The opposite is going to be the case. Oh, shoot, it just did it. Okay, so I'll go ahead and tell you guys. There was an update in the program, and I can no longer open my program the way I'm supposed to be able to. And so it does this. All the updates are always such a huge improvement. I don't know about you, but I always feel like they're an improvement. 100% of the time. And so now what happens is if I touch my thumb on the wrong place on the page, it jumps ahead two or three pages. It's never done that. And so I can't figure out how to turn it off yet because it happened this morning. All right. So there we are. So we're taking a closer look at this. The fool, listen to this shocking picture. The fool will no longer be called noble, nor the scoundrel said to be honorable. For the fool speaks folly, and his heart is busy with iniquity, to practice ungodliness, to utter error concerning the Lord, to leave the cravings of the hungry unsatisfied, and to deprive the thirsty of drink. This is the proverbial, literally from the book of Proverbs, the fool. Many years ago, when I was out at Pine Cove, I did a managerial training where I took all the teachings and Proverbs of the fool, the scoffer, and the wicked, and the wise and the righteous, and divided them into three headings, and took those passages and took them apart as literally guidance on how to manage people. Once you recognize you're dealing with a fool, what do you do? Once you recognize you've got a wise or righteous person, what do you do? Once you realize you've got a scoffer or a wicked person, what do you do? And Proverbs is very clear. It's hard to know, especially with the fool. Because the fool, the consequences of the fool's actions are terrible. Their motives are pure. They mean to do well. They're just too dumb to pull it off. They keep trying things, and it doesn't work. People go hungry. They didn't mean for people to go hungry. They just end up going hungry. They had a great plan. It just doesn't play out well. They speak not maliciously, but error. In this new culture, under this king and these princes, whoever they are, fools will be recognized, catch this, as fools. The whole culture will know it. Somehow we will know, oh, that guy's a fool. How about that? Verse 7, as for the scoundrel, his devices are evil. He plans wicked schemes to ruin the poor with lying words, even when the plea of the needy is right. People will not get honor who don't have any. People will not be respected who are not respectable. Fools will be understood as fools. People who cannot make things better, physically or spiritually. And scoundrels, which are even worse than fools, because they do that maliciously. As a therapist, I will tell you, I run into all the time, there are spouses who are bad spouses, and they're trying, and they're just bad at it. And there are others who are just evil. They are wicked and abusive. They are controlling and narcissistic. They are out for their own. They don't care how it affects other people. They don't care how it affects their families, so long as they get what they want. In this world, it isn't that these people will not exist, but we'll all know who they are. That would be amazing. It would be amazing, the fool who accidentally and ignorantly creates chaos, the scoundrel who strategically attempts to do evil and ignores the right thing to do, even when those needing of compassion are asking for it. They will be seen for what they are under this rule. Imagine that. Imagine a world in which those who lead us are able to cause the fool to reveal themselves as a fool, and the wise to reveal themselves as wise, and the whole culture can call that out with accuracy. That would be phenomenal. The freedom that would come in that would be unbelievable. Most importantly, by the way, the noble will be seen as noble because they can stand on their noble deeds. Verse 8, but he who is noble plans noble things, and on noble things he stands. Noble is the character trait of seeking to do what is right. Those who seek to do what is right. No one's perfect. None of us can always do what is right. But those who seek to do what is right. Imagine a day when someone gets asked a question. They get asked a question in their role as leadership, and they're able to say, well, look at my record. That should speak for itself, shouldn't it? This is what, when I talk with Michael about being in basketball, let your game speak for itself. You don't have to talk about it. Let your game speak for itself. This is a great lesson for anyone. There's nothing to, if you got something to prove, then something's off. Instead, to be able to say, no, this is what, look at my noble, you want to know whether I'm noble? Well, check out my track record, and then you tell me, am I noble? Am I seeking to do what is right? I don't claim perfection. And by the way, this would be, and nobility is always connected biblically to the concept of generosity. Generous with time, generous with money, generous with talent. Those who are likely to lead others to become more like this as well. Those are those who are noble. It's easy to forgive everything else when you know someone is trying to do what's right. How blessed would be a nation or a kingdom in which people are seen and reckoned as they are. No hypocrisy, no prejudice, just accuracy and justice. Man. But what do you think? Is it several kings and leaders, or is it just one man? Is it just one king that we're talking about? Well, now we're back in prophecy land. And let me just take a moment and comment on this. We're not just with this type of leader talking about political leadership only. Although that's an obvious jump because that's what the passage is talking about. But any leadership, the leadership of a husband and a father, of a mother, of a wife, what does it look like for us to lead in this way? What does it look like for us to lead as he does? We're going to come back to that, but unless my app already skipped it. All right, so generous. He is generous. The several kings, that's where I want to go. Listen, are we back in the prophecy land, this idea of the birth pangs? Listen, is there a sense in which these things have been fulfilled or were fulfilled in their time? In a sense, an exaggerated sense, yes. Hezekiah ends up being a great king. He ends up listening to Isaiah, and instead of fleeing to Egypt, instead of coming up with his own solution, instead of trying to come up with his own plan, he pulls the people in the walls, and they stay in the walls, and in the end, God fights for them, destroys the Assyrians, and they're safe. He's not perfect. He makes some mistakes, for sure. He then invites the Babylonians in and shows off his wealth. They take really good records of that and come back 100 years later and take it all. Do you see others? We see the king Josiah, who's going to be later, who will fulfill this. This king who comes and brings a nation and a people back into alignment with Yahweh. One of the greatest religious reformers of all times, Josiah. Do they fulfill these things? Yes, of course, in a sense they do. But in prophecy, there's always a final push back to our birth pangs model. There's a birth pangs, there's a pain, and then there's no baby. Then there's the pain again, and there's no baby. And then once again we see it, and there's no baby, until finally the birth pain comes, and now you've got a baby. Let's look back at the words describing this person again. A hiding place. A shelter. Where? In a dry place. In a wilderness. Like streams of water in a dry place. Like shade of a great rock. It's clearly a reference to the people of Israel back to their nomad days, and probably a wink back at Egypt, which we've been talking about. In fact, there's rock, and there's wilderness, and there's a safe place without water, and then there's water. It made me think clearly of the rock at Meribah, where Moses struck the rock at God's command and water came out. For those of you who don't know, this actually is the logo of our church. This is the purpose of meant to express this. Dead rock that is transformed into living water, poured out into the world, the way Christ says. This is our picture. I could tell you the Apostle Paul had an opinion of who fulfilled this imagery of the rock and water. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." He is that fulfillment. He is the complete fulfillment of this leader, of these princes. He is the ultimate King of kings and Lord of lords. By the way, did you know it was common belief, it was Jewish legend, it's nowhere in the Bible, but it was Jewish legend, that when Moses struck the rock at Meribah, a piece of the rock broke off. And according to legend, that piece of rock followed, rolling in the sand, followed the people of Israel for all 40 years. Again, it's not in the Bible, fun story, but that's probably what Paul is referencing here, is the fact that his audience would have thought this was known about this legend and would have said, this rock following us around all the time, yes, the pillar of fire, the pillar of smoke, yes, the smoke rising up from the tabernacle itself, yes, all these were Jesus, even the rock that followed us was Christ. He is with us and is always with us. He is the ultimate expression. These will be the leaders to lead them well into the model of the one great King, the chosen Messiah, Jesus Christ, the name above all names. How does this passage align with the others? Well, it's about who he is. That's how it does. The lion, the hen, the king, not a king, the king, our hope. God came near, our lion, the lamb who on the throne who died in our place. This is who he is revealed in Isaiah. Then God, through Isaiah, takes a hard turn from excitement and comfort about a coming kingdom, and he turns to the ladies. So these men, these great men of leadership who he's using as a model, he's now going to turn to the ladies instead. And he's going to bring some bad news to the ladies, specifically the lazy and rebellious ones. Are you ready for this? He wants to warn them about a coming crisis. Well, I mean, it's at least a crisis for them. I do want you to keep in mind that women of these cultures represented the culture. Then in this day, women kind of represented the culture. That when an enemy was conquered, very often a letter or a song was sung to the women of that culture. They were the ones who experienced the loss of their sons and fathers and husbands. They were the ones who cared enough about what was going on in their culture, who really had the heart for that. So here, I believe God, through Isaiah, is warning the people of a crisis to come, but I think the crisis is very intentional, and I think it's from him. Ready? Verse 9. "Rise up, you women who are at ease. Hear my voice, you complacent daughters. Give ear to my speech. In a little more than a year, you will shudder, you complacent women." What's going to make them so scared? What's going to make them shudder? What's going to grab hold of their heart and shake them? "For the grape harvest fails. The fruit harvest will not come." In other words, they're going to run out of wine. This is what this is about. This is the big event that God is bringing to his people. And a little more than a year probably means like a year and a day type of thing. It's maybe an idiom, but it almost certainly is targeting this time next year. In other words, next year's harvest. After God has saved them from the Assyrians, the next year's harvest of grapes will fail. Verse 11, tremble, you women who are at ease. Shudder, you complacent ones. Strip and make yourselves bare. Tie sackcloth around your waist. Beat your breasts for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine, for the soil of my people growing up in thorns and briars. Yes, for all the joyous houses in the exultant city. All of this for the loss of wine. You remember back in chapter 24, he has this very kind of sarcastic, tongue-in-cheek reference to the loss of wine, meaning that there will be no more gladness in the land? I think we can all understand this. It turns out, I realized a few years ago that I started having this weird cough and trying to figure out what it was, and we've tried all these different things. It turns out, almost certainly what it is this invisible form of reflux. And so, apparently, that's the deal that's going on. How you have an invisible disease, I don't know, but that's apparently the thing that's going on that I'm supposed to take care of. So I look up, okay, Dr. ChatGPT, what am I supposed to do to treat this invisible reflux that apparently that I have? No idea what it is. What am I supposed to do to treat it? And Chat comes back and says, hey, good news. All you've got to do is no more coffee, no more strong or spicy foods, no more smoking of pipes or tobaccos, and you should be good. And I was like, no. I mean, is there like a drug I can take? Like, I don't want to change my life. What the heck? I don't. I guess I'll just cough for the rest of my life. That's just going to be the consequences of this, right? All this for the loss of wine. Like, it means there's no more happiness to come. If someone ever looked you in the eyes and said, wow, who died? And you said, well, no one, but I'm out of wine. You may have a problem. You may need to get help. What is going on in a culture when the women who represent the culture express all levels of shame and grief and guilt as if the absolute worst calamity has happened to these people, and it's all because they can't get wine? Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you're thinking, I get it, then I need to introduce you to the dangers of alcohol dependency. One-third, according to the research, one-third of Texas women report at least one binge drinking episode per month. On average, one-third per month. And by the way, you go like, man, I'm glad I'm not those people. A binge drinking episode is considered 4+ drinks in one occasion. Some of you are like, oh, how about that? If you're a Christ follower, I would love to really encourage you. If you're someone who's trying to take Scripture and apply it to your life when it comes to alcohol, I would love to encourage you that I think the appropriate number would be 0 times a year for how often we are binge drinking to the point that where we are affected, intoxicated, drunk. I think that's what Scripture would teach us. Incidentally, defensiveness about drinking statistics is a symptom of alcohol dependence. So if you find yourself in your head going like, whatever, that can't be right, I'm not saying it, I'm just letting you know. Is the world dependent on numbing agents to make it? Yes. Should Christians be? No. I think this is why. God's revealed word does not condemn drinking of alcohol. God's word does not condemn the drinking of alcohol. In fact, God prizes being better at making alcohol. In several different places, prophetically, and even in the New Testament, Jesus makes it. This is a great picture of exactly what we've been talking about week after week. Are we hearing it yet? Do we get it yet? Good things from God are fine. Trusting in them is not. Needing them, being dependent on them, is not. That's exactly been the point over and over again. Good things from God are good. Family and friends, finances, money, a good church. These are good things that God has given us. Are you dependent on them? Then it's a problem. Are we trusting in them instead of Him? Then it's a problem. That's exactly why I think the Bible, not condemning alcohol completely, does condemn drunkenness. Because one shows trusting in God, but you could enjoy a good thing He's given you. The other shows trusting in that thing instead of Him. How offensive that God would give a good thing and then we would begin to idolize it and depend on it instead of Him. I remember so distinctly being awakened to this a couple of decades ago when I was on a jury And we found a guy guilty, put him in prison for 66 years in order to protect the little girl who he had abused. And as we're leaving after days of this intense, difficult time, and we walk out of the courthouse here in Tyler, and the other 11 only know one way to deal with the stress and difficulty that they've been facing, and that's to go across the street to the bar. Now, I'm not patting myself on the back or anything like that. I just remember thinking, like, I need some time alone with the Lord. I need some time alone with some friends and close friends and family to kind of debrief and detox from these last few days. I didn't feel the need to numb. That was not my impression at all. Remember, God has something better than drunkenness or being numb in the face of the challenges of life. He has something better. He may not immediately fix everything for us, and he certainly doesn't. The Assyrians are still coming at this time. But he has something better promised. Things may look bad now, but he's not done working, as we sung about many times a few minutes ago. Verse 14, for the palace is forsaken. The populous city deserted. The hill and the watchtower will become dens forever. A joy of wild donkeys. A pasture of flocks. Until the Spirit is poured out from on high and the wilderness becomes a fruitful field. And the fruitful field is deemed a forest. Things will not always be bleak. He will bring things to fulfillment in His plan. His plan, not ours. His plan. And His plan is extraordinary. After all, He is that King. He's promising that eventual future. We don't need to numb now because we have hope for then. We could take hope in knowing who He is and His character now. When He takes charge, things will change. Verse 16, then righteousness will dwell even in the wilderness. The righteousness abide in the fruitful field. The effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. My people will abide in peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Those places where you used to grow the wine that you used to numb out will become instead producers of righteousness and justice. And those will bring actual peace, not just a numbed out sense of avoidance. This is pure poetry from God through Isaiah. Justice even in the wilderness. There will be justice even where there's no people. Righteousness will be everywhere. You couldn't escape it if you wanted to. The unjust and unrighteous, the lawbreakers and the evil and the wicked will have no place. The effect / accomplishment, consequence, this is the Hebrew here, of this type of saturated righteousness, what does it create? Peace. Shalom. Real peace. Identity level peace. What could steal our peace? Nothing. There's no place for those who steal peace to go. And it's a different word. The word here, effect, the first one, to labor, to construct. What does righteousness construct? What is the consequence of its labor? Is quietness. What a great word. But the next one, bitach, doesn't just mean the peace of quiet. It means the peace of safety. That you go, wow, what I find myself numbing is the damage from the past and the fear of the future. Right? Get it? Here we have God saying, I'm going to take all that away. The feeling of insecurity, of fear, of competition that you feel all the time, I'm going to take it away forever. These are the consequences of His reign. The very consequences of the construction of His kingdom. His kingdom is literally made of the stones of peace and quiet and security. That will be the future that we have someday. We don't always have it now. We get tastes of it here, but what's sad is so often we flee from it. We have our own plan. We have our own solution. Our plan is to run this way or to drink this thing or to do this thing in order to not have to see the reality of it. Verse 19, we get this wonderful, crazy verse in verse 19. And it will hail when the forest falls down, and the city will be utterly laid low. Man, you read that and you're like, what is this? Where does this verse come from? And it's been debated, by the way, for centuries, what exactly God is saying here. A lot of the rabbis from early on connected it to Isaiah 10. Remember Isaiah 10, when God talks about the armies of Assyria being like a forest, imagining spears, so many spears it looks like a forest, the glory of His forest being His being the Assyrian king, and of His fruitful land the Lord will destroy both soul and body, and it will be as when a sick man wastes away. That was his promise back then. Maybe that's it. This is God saying, hail is usually considered a sign of God's judgment. That his judgment is, I'm going to see this forest coming, and I'm going to level it for you. Certainly what he does. Some people think this is an agricultural promise. Hey, the forests which are in your way, if you're an agricultural people, you think of forests as a problem. That you go, this forest that's in my way, that's in your way, I'm going to level it. I'm going to take away all of your wine as an act of purification to turn you back to me. And when you do, I will then level fields for new plants. Because it's not that I want to take these things away from you, it's that I want you to look to me. I'm clearing out space. Even the animals don't need to have protection in this place, in this new land. I'm going to level cities for you. I'm going to level forests for you. I'm going to clear out the land for the ox and the donkey. Verse 20, happy are you when you sow beside all waters, who let the feet of the ox and the donkey range free. Life is just going to be life lived out there in the world, unafraid. There's a day coming, peace and justice so saturated to every cell of our existence, we're allowed to and encouraged to hope for this day, even when things are hard now. When things are really, really tough, I encourage you to stop and get still and ponder what a limitless God who has limitless love for you and limitless creativity for you, what it is, why he's done all this in the first place, what it is that he may have in store for us someday. As hard as things can be now, what will it be like to talk about it 1,000 years from now, or 10,000 years from now, or 100,000 years from now? We celebrate when human leaders look even a little like him, the leaders of our homes and communities. Husbands, fathers, does our leadership look like this? Do we seem like a guardian lion who guards against evil? A guardian lion, a predator that's facing outward to protect those who God has given to us? How many of our homes, men, are we actually the predator who faces inward? We are the person that our wives and our children fear the most. God forbid, let it not be that they would experience the opposite of that. That we're not fools and we're certainly not scoffers. A sacrificial ox who lays down his life, or even much harder things, who lays down his preferences, who lays down his moods, who lays down his bad choices, demands, wants, desires, that he lays these things down for his family like a sacrificial ox. Mothers, wives, do we cover like a mother hen, protecting at our own expense? Do we watch over and protect our marriages like a watchful bird? Or do we instead, men and women, do we bring in, invest in, and hide sin in our homes? You know, even most dumb animals, low animals, know not to bring their own excrement into their own home. And yet, how often are we doing exactly that? Do we bring in and invest in and hide our sin? Are we a jealous lion, not that protects our family for the sake of God, that protects our own evil from accountability and insight? Is it our comfort we jealously watch over? Do we serve like this in our communities, in our schools, in our church, in the kingdom? That's my encouragement to us. Is we'd be challenged to live this out. We are talking about discipleship over and over again, year after year, month after month, day after day here, which is becoming a little bit more like our Savior. It's enough that the student becomes like their teacher and the servant like their master. I want to invite you to stand with me. As we look to and figure out what is it that God is calling us to in our hearts right now. If you've been through our welcome home process and you're ready to come and join this dysfunctional family, you can do that in a minute when we sing. If you say, I recognize there are things in my life that are not in alignment with him and I need to change that. That needs to change. I need to put myself and be modeling him in my home. It turns out, church, that our hope is in the character of Christ. Not in our understanding, it's not in our knowledge. Is he the king who can save us? Is he powerful enough to defeat sin and conquer death? Just enough to face our sins and still protective to pay our debt with all his sufficient merit? If he is, then he's our hope. And if he isn't, then we have none. Anything else can and will fail us. Is our faith laid on something else but his character and his person? If it is, it's time for a transfer of soul from there to him. James 5 says this, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. The very words of God.